Hey Sarah, how you doing?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Welcome to my kitchen.
I love it. What a cup selection you have.
Thank you very much. It took me a while to position it accordingly. It's so uniform. It's nice. Bright sunny day. Good stuff. It is. And it is. Well, thanks for taking the time to chat with us today. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing more about what you're up to at the Rockefeller Foundation. But I want to start. I know you've been doing some traveling. I know you spent some time in Europe and the Netherlands. Maybe you can share with us a bit some of the things you learned over there and what's of interest recently over in
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dutch.
It's been a busy month. I feel so many folks are trying to make up for lost time after so little travel during COVID. But for us, we were spending time really trying to kickstart this regenerative and agroecological indigenous foodways portfolio. Spent some time on a regenerative dairy farm in the Netherlands with farmers just, up close and personal, seeing what it means, what the challenges are, what the payoff is, what the motive is. That was with a group called Common Lands. And Common Lands has a sort of federated network of over 250 farms in the Netherlands. And together they've set this really exquisite, sort of multi-dimensional vision for what long-term regeneration means in terms of biodiversity, soil, animal health, animal welfare, social community coherence. It's just really inspiring. So spend some time doing that. Also spend some time with this new fabulous network of networks on regenerative called Regen 10, which unifies farmers, indigenous people, business, science, all trying to come together to figure out how do we advance the evidence? How do we build a sort of network of proof points so we can see what is this? What is working in one place? What is a total flop elsewhere? And how do we activate the resources and the conversation really to transition from conventional synthetic input-driven agriculture to this alternative paradigm? And then we also had a really exciting conversation with a large number of funders, 17 actually, together saying, okay, if we are to collaborate on this agenda, this regenerative agenda, and we could co-finance something serious, what might it look like? And so a lot of pretty big ideas came out of that meeting. And I think there's a serious commitment going into COP28 and with the leadership. Minister Almeri is showing there in the UAE with her colleagues to put food at the absolute center of what next year's climate summit will be. And so we would be foolish not to take that opportunity and really get serious about trying to be as deeply collaborative as we can to advance that agenda. So the wheels are turning for COP28.
Yeah, well, so many things you mentioned there that I want to include in our conversation today. First, William Ferwerda and his work with Common Land is wonderful, and they've been doing it for such a long period of time and at mass scale. I mean, 10,000 hectares. It is wonderful to see that these are well past just POCs, and
That's
this
right.
is these are scenarios that are proving that this can be done. Tied to your question, though, and I want to talk about COPs and a couple. COP 27, COP 28, but you had mentioned an aggregate of a bunch of funders. And I'd love to get your point of view there, because I think that's a lot of our listeners would be intrigued by that. Is the discussion about, regen and testing and toeing the waters and how that's going to be done. But investing in those types of programs is much more sophisticated because it's real assets, it's new innovations, it's indigenous mind share, it's methodologies that have been out there for 10,000 years, but have been lost in recent times. How does financing work for those types of programs? Because it's an amalgam of so many different things all at once.
I mean, you framed it so well. I think it's not just the size of the undertaking to transition toward regenerative that requires funders to go at it together. It is because of those multiple complexities you just spoke to. And so I think, this is the beginning of trying to sort out where is the intersection between various funders' current expertise in regen, like who are the landscape stewards and the farmers they're funding, and what are their needs? And then how do we sort of find leverage within this tent of funders to really double down in ways that are productive and meaningful? I'll say, a couple of the hypotheses. We did some analysis for the last 6 months going into this meeting so that we could come really prepared just to try to put a number on how much money is currently going to Regen. And
right.
what is it exactly financing? Our analysis offered a spread because a lot of these funds will speak about a number and you can't quite tell if they've actually invested that number, if that is their aspiration. 5 billion to 13 billion right now. And I would not say that that's a categorical or definitive, we should probably treat it as a conservative estimate, right? Because there's no way we saw everything. But most people don't think we're anywhere near that. I didn't think we were anywhere near that. I mean, this picture is so fragmented. So if you're a farmer, if you're a landscape steward, you don't know how to access all these funds.
Right.
So one hypothesis could be what funders could do is we could create and really, you know, empower partners, many of whom are actually talking about creating this, to enable a kind of acceleration facility that as much as anything would be offering technical assistance and matchmaking into this kind of fragmented patchwork quilt of funds. And yeah, there's probably additionality needed as well. I think that could be one slightly more modest, but likely hugely helpful offering that funders could put on the table. So I think that's one thing to look at. Another thing is, how do we stoke national level leadership? I mean, what countries want to come out in front on this and say, you know what, this is where we're putting money. This is where we're examining our subsidies. This is where we're going to optimize our policies. This is where we're listening to our farmers and we're really celebrating the landscapes that are going on this journey. I think it's really exciting to think about elevating a group of countries that want to be featured on the global stage with that level of ambition. And that maps to, I think, where the UAE is really excited to create a platform for high ambition countries for food systems transformation and seeing this regenerative agroecological work as kind of a key vertical or proof point there.
It is fascinating when you start breaking down because you have, you know, the commingling of resources, right? Because what country is stepping? Just we're recording this on Valentine's Day, February 14th, but yesterday, yeah, right. I missed the memo, so
I did.
But the Biden Harris administration came out yesterday announcing $10+ billion going to NRCS for programs dedicated towards better, smarter practices for land management, for food production, large-scale infrastructure. How much of those funding parties that you're dealing with, that aggregate of you know, unique players that are really the tip of the spear in moving this along, how much are you working with federal agencies, whether it's UAE, whether it's European countries, or you know, domestically or stateside? Are you in those conversations?
We actually had Vilsack there with us. He came in and offered this sort of U.S. perspective. You know, and there's a lot to be excited about. And when we zoom out globally, we still have $600 to $800 billion in subsidies, 80% of which is holding the system in place as hard as it can to
right.
keep doubling down on monoculture and industrially driven conventional agriculture. So I think that's the very sobering thing, that even if you succeed as a group of ambitious funders like the Rockefeller Foundation, like IKEA, like Bezos Earth Funds, UKF CDO, it was quite a list. You're still going up against, you know, 80% of 800, $600 billion a year working against this agenda. So I think, yes, there's a lot to get excited about happening in the US and elsewhere. And then there are still those funding flows through subsidies that are not really making this shift easier. And that's everything from, you know, crop insurance, risk insurance, and the list gets pretty long.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's glacial. It's huge. It's, you know, for a reason we're at $7+ billion and it's almost mindset shift of embracing that and now future scope. And I, you had mentioned COP28. I want to talk about that, but I wish maybe you can take us back to last fall in Egypt and COP27. You had a large presence there. You know, the Rockefeller Foundation had a large presence there. You were involved in different initiatives. Tell us, maybe if you could, some of the good and the bad around food production related to climate action as a major pillar. You know, where do we stand with food in that play?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've probably heard this from others, but it really did feel like food arrived. You know, we were no longer the little kid in the back of the room. We really did have a voice and presence. There were more than 200 food focus events. There were four or five food-focused pavilion. So multiple, like I wasn't in most of those conversations just because you could only be in one place at a time, but it felt like an absolute feast. And I think what was also exciting, it wasn't the food conversations only happening in the food pavilions. It was seeing this also expressed in the Indigenous Peoples Pavilion, in the Youth Pavilion, the WHO Pavilion. You know, there are these other spaces where food was really starting to get more centrality in terms of answering the question, if we are to curb greenhouse gas emissions, if we are to adapt to a warming planet, what do we need to transform? And you have to put food in your answer to that question if you care about the one third of greenhouse gas emissions coming from this sector. So visibility, great. I think one of the things I'm most proud of that the Rockefeller Foundation supported together with a lot of our contemporaries in a group called the Global Alliance for the Future of Food, which is like 40 philanthropies that are all really asking how we can serve people, nature, planet better through food systems. We sponsored a number of Indigenous youth, eco-activists, and I think it was so important because then it's not our voice, you know, with these privileged positions in philanthropy. It was direct frontline farmers, food sovereignty advocates, youth like Gie Batista, who is, you know, just a voice for the next generation, thinking about what it means to live in a planet that may not be at 1.5 degrees warmer, maybe much warmer, and what that means for her generation in terms of what they're fighting for, the strategies that they want to see unleashed, and the power that they absolutely deserve to have in articulating these go forward strategies. They cannot be recipients. They need to be co-creators. So that felt really exciting because I observed what happened when individuals like Jie, like Matt Wilson, the food sovereignty director from the Sichangu Development Corporation on the Rosebud Indian Reservation, South Dakota. What happened when he was on stage talking to an audience next to me? I mean, he just has so much credibility and authenticity and lived experience about the things that we're speaking from, sometimes from a more technocratic perspective. So loved seeing that. Still a long way to go. I mean, let's be clear. COP remains still a very elite space. Just the cost of the ticket, right? The insane cost of the hotels. Like, this is not just something you kind of waltz into, not to mention trying to get a badge, which is, you know, equivalent to getting some kind
Super
of,
Bowl ticket.
a Super Bowl ticket. So still too much elitism there and sort of isolation. Other wins, you know, I think there were some pretty serious commitments put on the table for food systems. The Rockefeller Foundation, we came with a first ever for our institution suite of investments to build the evidence, the local empowerment, and the proof points on regenerative and agroecological food systems. I mean, that's a totally unique play for us, and it felt really celebrated. You know, that people, there's just a lot of receptivity, I think, to us moving in that direction, which was fabulous. On the flip side, you know, it's you can have this sort of split reality where I just felt so filled with hope, you know, engaging with Indigenous people and youth, and we were physically right next to the youth pavilion, and just, you cannot help but be moved and feel like there are people that all they are doing is thinking about making a pathway through this climate hell that we are careening toward. And we're going to get to the other side because of them, because they exist. And that's so hopeful. And yet, then you come out at, you know, bleary-eyed at 11 p.m. or whatever, and you hear that the negotiations are stuck and we're not making the commitments on fossil fuels. Like, that's just a big piece of this puzzle. And so it can feel like the negotiators are having one experience that we have almost no influence on. And then the folks really trying to advocate and move agendas and shape some of the funding flows are somewhere else in the blue zone or the green zone, and never the two shall meet. And that's, we've got to break down that wall. I also still continue to believe, like, many of these conversations, I can kind of eyeball and know most of the people in the audience or know their institutional affiliation. So I think by nature of the difficulty to get to COP, those institutions that prioritize being there are a select bunch. And I, you know, it's conversations like this, Erin, where you've got a community of folks that maybe don't know me, maybe don't know the Rockefeller Foundation, the work we're doing. And that's what we need to be doing. We need to be breaking down silos, breaking down the wall, bringing everyone in together. And I'm just not convinced this COP yet succeeded in that. And we need to keep fighting that fight. And the last bit I'll put in the sort of the negative column, there's one particular mechanism in the actual mechanism of COP to bring food and food security together with climate. And it's called the Corinivia Joint Work for Agriculture. Wonky name, but that mechanism really matters. And it's been on a bit of a like lifeline trying to get oxygen to continue. And basically, it was just dying in the background while we were all talking about regenerative and healthy diets and sustainable consumption. Over here, Corinivia was just breathing its last breath. It got a bit of an infusion right there at the end, so it's on a bit of like an extended sort of SOS period. So it's not dead yet, but to me, that's another kind of point where, if we're trying to drive certain agendas, but if we take our eye off the ball, the actual mechanisms used to write the nationally determined commitments, the national adaptation plans, where the rubber hits the road, is food in there or is it totally invisible? Corinivia matters, and we did not succeed in elevating it the way it needs to be elevated.
It is challenging without a doubt, because that entrenched, those incumbents, the entrenched incumbents are not fighting tooth and nail. They have their own objectives and agendas, right? And sometimes it feels like the fringe element to their food is, like you're saying, yeah, we go eat before we talk about the real negotiations, right? Not about that we have 7 plus 8 billion people on this planet that all need to eat, and our mechanisms of change can actually be from those empowerment of people, because we all are eaters, and 3 times daily we become climate warriors if we start to vote with our dollars for actually getting people engaged and understanding where their food come from. But
If
keep me at that. Go ahead, please. Yeah,
well,
I'll.
just to say, if one has the means to do so, 3 billion people cannot afford a healthy diet, right? So that's almost 50% of the 7 billion we have on the planet. And then many of the people that, you know, just barely can afford a healthy diet are reliant on various government systems to either provide the signaling or to actually deliver the food needed, whether that's school meals, meals in hospitals, meals in prisons, meals in militaries, right? Those meals aren't optimized to, they're certainly not optimized for the sustainability footprint. They're often not optimized for nutrition. So that's actually one of the programmatic areas we have at the Rockefeller Foundation, is trying to shift toward good food from price first for contracting to really thinking through the nutritional, local, economic, environmental, and other footprint of our food dollars through public procurement programs. Because it is sadly the case that I think that empowerment, like you get to choose with the 3 meals, is still kind of stated through the prism of assuming one has 3 meals, that one gets to make choices. Your one is not in a food desert, right? Or food swamp, where the choices still wouldn't let you optimize even if you had the dollar. So I think for those who can, yes, every bite is expressing your sort of eco consciousness. And then for those reliant on other programs, that's where we need to be really engaging with government and other suppliers to be thinking in the way you're advising.
Well, and actually, great cue up, because my question related to that too is some of the positive things, at least coming out of, or maybe learning from where we had to improve from COP27, and where positivity came out, was the ICANN initiative, the Initiative for Climate Action and Nutrition, which was GAIN, it was World Health, it was FAO, which is, to your point, focused on nutrition first, but working with these large incumbent players so that they can start to coax in these discussions around, it is a matter of fact that we have to make these changes. So getting ahead of it, being preemptive and proactive, can have huge positive impact for many, for the bottom line, for, because it's the right thing to do, because we have a shrinking, warming planet that need these things. So how do we take those types of initiatives and some of the things that you mentioned before and head into COP28? So we learned, got a year, to incubate. Now, what's the angle? How do we change that differently going into COP28 in Dubai?
Yeah, I mean, I think within the kind of food tent, we need more discipline. We need to get clearer and sharper about what exactly we're advocating for. I think when you've been outside of the tent for so long and you finally just get to like squeak in, you've got so much to say. You're just saying everything and you don't know what's going to stick. And it's felt a little like that in these last two COPs where food has been such a like, you know, orphan to the conversation. We're just so happy to be there. We're maybe too exuberant. And I think this COP, partly because of the emphasis from UAE on food being a very like central strategic priority, it forces us to just be more disciplined. What are the fewer things and how do these, I mean, the number of initiatives, I still can't track all the initiatives that came out of that pertain to food, right? It's just, it's an inordinate amount. Like if you think about the programming alone, right? There's what, like 500 plus pavilions. They're doing 40 hours of programming. Just do the math. Like who's listening
Massive.
To,
I know.
You know, like that amount, 20,000 hours of programming. I don't know everything that was said. So I think the work, and I'm seeing it and I'm heartened. I am seeing efforts like the Food Forward Consortium and others really saying, okay, let's tighten up the aperture. Let's come very clear about high ambition countries. Let's come clear about regen financing mechanisms. And I think we're going to get to a shorter list. So I think that will be part of what we undertake in these next few months and really what is going to be a sprint toward COP. And I think, you know, what the Rockefeller Foundation is prepared to do is to use our influence, our convening power, and our fabulous community around us to come at the intersection of the needs of farmers, the needs of landscape stewards, the needs of indigenous people as pertinent to agroecological regenerative food systems so that we can offer something concrete, high impact, and durable. Not just a thing we talk about at COP, but durable well beyond it to start to get to the bigger question, which is what would it take to shift 50% of global agriculture to regenerative by 2030, 2040, you know, sometime soon. That's like the level of the question we want to both bring to COP with a set of prototypes to answer it.
So we've talked about regenerative a few times here, and I think it's a key thing to bring up because I know the Rockefeller Foundation has made large scale commitment towards regenerative, and it has become, you know, in our space, it's definitely been something that's been a rallying cry for a while. It is an inclusive discussion without a doubt. But it is being commandeered many times. It's kind of the next version of without defined standards, without program setup of what is regen, who is doing regen appropriately. We have our basic soil health and regen principles, as Gabe Brown would tell us, but without really a codified approach to what that really represents and what that impact is, a lot of those big incumbents are also becoming part of the regen story. What are you doing as heading the food initiative for Rockefeller Foundation? What are you doing to help differentiate or disassociate, or maybe even bring them into the mix so that you can help codify what regenerative looks like moving forward?
Well, and Roy Steiner is our lead for all food. I lead the global portfolio. I, you know, what we want to do is a few things. One, we want to help sort of elevate the fact that regenerative is built in a set of principles that we haven't created. Well, you know, I'm not old enough to have created those. For thousands of years, different communities practiced forms of agriculture connected to the kind of natural habitat, the ecosystem, the notion of community in a very different way than we think about, you know, industrialized agriculture today. So one, we have to acknowledge and have, I think, greater reverence for the roots of this entire conversation. So one, without that acknowledgement, we're already on the wrong foot. Two, you know, you said it's a very inclusive agenda. It can be, but also to your point, it can also be very prone to greenwashing. The way we're trying to kind of work through those really tough dynamics is to think of regenerative as a spectrum. So if you imagine the spectrum going from shallow to deep, on the shallow side, yes, you're talking about greenhouse gas emissions, carbon sequestration, and soil health. Oh, that's huge. That's a tremendous, tremendous achievement over where we have been. But it doesn't come close to getting to the midpoint, let alone to deep. To get to the midpoint, we need to be considering biodiversity. I mean, biodiversity loss, the biggest driver to it is the food system, right? Where 80 to 90% of deforestation, 60, 70% of biodiversity loss is food, right? You can build back that biodiversity through regenerative, partly because one third of living species exist beneath the surface of the soil, right? There's so much biodiversity and complexity in our soils that we don't even fully understand. But we can build that back, but then above soil biodiversity as well, both through agrobiodiversity, planting lots of things next to each other, but also natural barriers that allow for different types of wildlife to come back in closer proximity and to greater symbiosis with fields that are planted. We don't get to, so, you know, shallow is the carbon soil, midpoint is biodiversity, water quality. We don't get to deep until we start considering humans and societies and communities, building the well-being, so not just profit, but the well-being of farmers and landscape stewards, to reconnect communities to their spiritual and cultural traditions, which if I lost my land, if my land was taken, if my spiritual tradition included reverence for the jaguar, for example, for the Seminole people in Florida, but those jaguars are almost completely gone. I am actually not able to practice my spiritual tradition. When that jaguar comes back, when the land is restored, my spirituality, the very essence of who my people are, is restored to. Like, that is a profound way to measure the outcome of regenerative. So again, thinking of this shallow, medium, deep spectrum, what we want to do as Rockefeller is create the incentives and the space to really lean toward deep. It doesn't mean not counting and not encouraging entities that have nothing to do with this to put a toe in the water, get into the pool. But it is to say it's not binary. You're not regenerative or not regenerative, which gets to this, you know, enigma in all of it, which is, how do you define regenerative? You know, FOLU, the Food and Land Use Coalition, just came out with a great report that was a couple of years in the making. This is 3 weeks old, so end of January. And they were trying to match practices to outcomes. And you know, the big thesis of that paper is you need an outcomes framework. If you could just have a shared outcomes framework on regenerative, then whether you're Pepsi or Unilever or the Deep Medicine Circle with the Romatush Ohlone people in Northern California, we can all be talking in a consistent vocabulary, and then we can actually do comparison. And what gives me a lot of hope is seeing the effort of Regen 10, where you have farmers, scientists, including FOLU, the World Business Council Sustainable Development, and a multitude of organizations actually doing a synthesis outcomes measurement framework with the ambition of doing a deep kind of consensus building and interrogation of that mechanism in time to bring it to COP28. So if all goes well, by COP, we will have, it'll still be a prototype. It'll still be going through rapid iteration, but we'll have a prototype outcomes measurement framework. And I think that's going to start to diminish the ability to greenwash this term. And it will enable conversations across constituencies that right now just cannot see eye to eye on what they're really aiming for. Because then you can look at it, you know, it's likely going to be an index with different pie slices, like a global farm metric kind of a mechanism. You can say, well, where are you on this one? We've turned up the dial on this, on nutrition and community empowerment. Oh, well, we've turned up the dial on water quality and soil health. Interesting. Let's compare and contrast. So I think a new chapter is going to open. We just have some serious work, and it's hard work to get there.
It is. And it is a, as you mentioned, it's a paradigm shift. And, you know, I always go back to what Fred Kirschman told us, which I think is, you know, and Gabe Brown, around the principles of regen, of course, but as Fred talked about, you know, this simple one line answer, and I think this is Aldo Leopold that said this originally, but we'll give it to Fred, is, you know, everything is renewed in the process of using it. And that process and that methodology and that approach, just thinking of it in that way, is connecting us back to nature instead of just forcibly controlling it all the time. And understanding how ecology works and understanding that practice and those procedures, when we get there, I think that's, you know, ultimately, whether we're in a boardroom, whether we're in the fields, or whether we're, because, you know, we've been mostly talking about terrestrial agriculture, but the same holds true if we start to farm the ocean, the appropriate methodology, which huge amounts of, I mean, the vast majority of life on the planet lives in aquatic environments. So all of that mindset of just being, again, connected to natural systems is such a key paradigm shift, which hopefully, as we keep going with these big conversations, more leadership, more negotiators, more of these discussions awaken to that. Or maybe the other ones that don't are the dinosaurs that kind of, you know, work their way out of over a period of time anyhow.
Totally. And it's one more reason why who's at the table and even like the design of the table has to change.
Yeah.
We will not get this right if this is business talking only to business. And frankly, even if it's just, you know, large farmers talking only to large farmers, we have to get the heterogeneity that fully reflects the food system into this conversation, because even the view of nature, you know, a colonial view of nature is one where we try to mimic nature or transform our processes to be more compatible with nature. An indigenous view is we are not apart from nature. We are nature.
Right.
We are the system. We are weavers of transformation and change. And so I think even how we're thinking about the climate, nature, planet, you know, combination in terms of what we're really trying to do to untangle the knot of all the crises we're facing, how we consider ourselves with respect to nature is one of the like profound sort of starting points for how we begin these agendas. And it's where I've personally felt like I'm just learning so much and still have so much to learn from the indigenous communities that are part of these conversations.
Yeah, and I want to give you a chance to tell us a bit more about what to look for from the Rockefeller Foundation. But I wanted to ask, speaking of you know, your specific and in your personal experience of this, how did you get into this in the first place? We all have our backstory. We all have, what is that passion? Sometimes it's grandma's kitchen. Sometimes it's it's other scenarios or parents or something. We stumble across an opportunity. You know, for you, what was it, Sarah? What got you into this?
Well, my grandfather actually was a farmer. The farm is now farmed by my uncle. This is in Arizona. And I remember he farmed wheat and cotton and watermelons, and just have these memories of being in the field, the watermelon fields, and just like the magic, the seeming magic of something so delicious and large, especially when you're looking at the size of a giant watermelon, and just the idea that you can tend to the earth and it can provide, and right there you can dig in, and he would take out his pocket knife and, you know, let me sample the watermelons. It seems so extraordinary. But, you know, I think like so many people that grew up in the 80s, I think my life was transformed with the Ethiopian famine, which was I think the first time with my life of, you know, relative privilege, certainly a lack of food insecurity as a direct experience, just the complete injustice, right? The idea that it's just random who cannot afford this food because of where they were born, the color of their skin, the distance to market, the decision by, you know, various parties to engage in trade with a country or not, and just the idea that whatever I was going to do, it needed to help the planet. And I always loved science and technology. I was a science and technology geek. So harnessing science and technology for development sort of became the call. And that's really what brought me into this career path of international development. And through science and technology, where you're looking through the lens of science and technology to poverty and development, you come first to agriculture. It's just, it's the largest employer. It is how families live or die. And so it just naturally kind of took me full circle back to the watermelons in Arizona. And it's just been an incredible journey and still full of so much learning.
Yeah.
And you know, an incredible community to learn from and with.
Well, if I had known, I would have had some watermelons camped up behind you on the counter right there. See, I only have oranges.
I would have just been
and
gobbling it.
Yeah, right. So I'm sorry. Sorry. Next time I know. Next conversation, we'll go
Please.
From there. So,
yeah.
All right. So as we mentioned, we're in mid-February and
no watermelon.
Well, yes, we can ship it from somewhere else in the world, I guess. But we got COP28 in November. What can we expect
December,
to see?
December this year. It's later.
It's December. Okay. So it's December. Okay.
Two more weeks to December.
End of the year. What can we expect to see over the course coming from Rockefeller Foundation in short order?
Certainly, you know, one of the big things, we are going to the board in June to put forward a climate strategy. So our entire institution is evolving more to be a climate forward institution. That means each of our programmatic areas, so food, but also health, power, innovative finance, all of these are currently deep in the sort of trenches, trying to consider how to take their existing bodies of work and tilt them even more toward climate outcomes.
Right.
So in all that, for the food team in particular, our food plus climate strategy is around regen and agroecology. Mm. So we will really be, I think, you know, one, working on this measurements framework work, the global networks, connecting up the proof points. And then, as I said at the top of this conversation, trying to link up, mobilize, and facilitate multiple funders to bring a substantial funding commitment around regen and potentially the design of a facility of some type to COP. We'll see. You know, I think with co-design processes, you feel the inspiration, and then you need to feel a lot of sense of team, because it means we will be designing this together. There's an emergent property to that. But yeah, I think it's going to be a really exciting year of work. And at the same time, we have other flagship initiatives, the periodic table of food that seeks to map and measure all of the biochemical compounds that make food food, of which we know almost none. I mean, we map and measure like 150 things in our food, right? Zinc, vitamin A, vitamin C. We don't talk about biochemical 3,425. We don't even know what it is. And yet our food is made of this stuff that has never been revealed. And we now have the bioinformatic, metabolomic, proteomic, glycomic, lipidomic science to do this. So we have a global federation of scientific institutions like UC Davis, like Wageningen, American Heart Association, CIOT in Colombia, mapping and measuring by the end of this year the first 1,000 foods consumed by humanity and putting it all in the public domain.
Wow.
So that's a pretty big offering to COP. Yeah.
So that's including phytonutrients, that's the nutrient density elements of food. I remember when Elaine Ingham tried to do this when she was the chief scientist at Rodale years ago, and I was almost scoffed at. So now we're actually going to get something like that. Wow, that's fantastic. Okay. Sorry to interrupt.
It is.
I just wanted clarification.
Yeah. So check it out. Periodic Table of Food Initiative, PTFI. Okay.
I'll make note of it in the write-up here.
Yeah, it's a really, I think, groundbreaking effort, which is why it's been, frankly, pretty easy to get the world's top scientific institutions. 7 of the 9 first are in the Global South, by the way, so it's super global effort, standardizing the technology to do this measurement. And then, you know, once you go from 1,000 foods, we'll quickly hope to go to 5,000 foods. And then you can imagine the various scientific questions you can answer and the mechanistic questions, right? So if it is, wow, why does kale actually have 10 times as much of biochemical 3,425 than this red lettuce? Does it matter? Does it matter for breast cancer? Does it matter for colon cancer? Right. So there's just the tidal waves of scientific inquiry this can unleash are so substantial. And frankly, without this, I think the pathway to personalized nutrition is it's very superficial, right? So this is really going to unleash. So yeah, that's a big priority for us coming into COP.
Fantastic. Well, Sarah, I know we went long, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I learned a great deal. I know our listeners will as well. So thank you very much for sparing the time and chatting with us. It's been great.
Oh, I had so much fun. I just so appreciate the fabulous questions, just the great energy, and hopefully your community will be as excited to go on this journey with us as we are to join them. So thanks for the time.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.